Hello. How's everybody doing? Everybody tired by now? I was just thinking, I'm so happy I'm not the last, the 4 o'clock. Who's going to make a 4 o'clock session? I'm impressed. I thought people would be going back to their hotels to get ready for that party tonight. People going to the party tonight? Everybody, yeah? All right. So my name is Scott Hunter. I'm a program manager at Microsoft on the web platform. So the team I work on builds. We build Visual Studio, the web extensions, the HTML editor, the CSS editor, all that stuff. We build ASP.NET, we build MVC, Web API, web pages, NuGet, a variety of stuff. And what I thought I'd come out today is come out and talk about what all is coming in ASP.NET 4.5. I'm not a big slide guy, so this is the slide. So I thought what would be more fun to do is just go and do a bunch of demos and show a bunch of stuff. So I'll quickly just look at these slides and talk a little bit to the stuff that's here. So lots of great stuff that's in ASP.NET 4.5. I broke it down into core ASP.NET, web forms, MVC, Web API, SignalR, and then something else we're calling one ASP.NET. First core ASP.NET, we did some really cool stuff. .NET 4.5 has this new async keyword called await, which makes writing async code really easy. In the past, if you've written async code, you have to write delegates and callbacks, and it's just ugly and it's a mess. And I'll show a demo of how easy it is to do in .NET 4.5. Something else that's in core .NET 4.5 is we have WebSocket support. So you might have heard you might have heard about this new standard called HTML5 WebSockets. We built full support for that in the framework. And SignalR takes advantage of that as well. Cool stuff. The next one, which I will do demos of, is web optimization. Funny story about web optimization, we were actually looking at the ASP.NET website a couple of years ago. And we're like, why does it take so long for these pages to come down? And we went and looked and said, oh, it's making 60 requests per page. And so we went and optimized our own site to get our load times under half a second. And when we did that, we thought, is there something we can do in the framework to support that? And so we put that in the framework. Something I don't have called out on the core ASP.NET is when you're running 4.5, you'll notice that your applications start up 30% faster than they did before. So we're continuing to work on perf. So we start 30% faster, and we use 30% less memory. So overall, much smaller footprint, faster startup, trying to keep making that get better. So web forms, I'm not going to go over these because I'm going to go over each of these things with demos. MVC, the same thing. I'm going to demo all the MVC stuff I have on the list here. I've got a Web API demo as well. Web API is kind of what we see the future of ASP.NET. Obviously, web forms and MVC aren't going away anytime soon. But we think, if you look at the Twitters and the Facebooks of the world, you basically access these things via APIs. And we think that people in the future will build more and more APIs on top of their applications. We've got SignalR, which is this cool real-time framework that we're building. If you think of SignalR, if you think of like a stock ticker that updates all the time or a notification that you have mail, that's what something like SignalR can be used for. I'm going to show a simple chat app that I wrote in about 5 lines of code. And then my favorite topic is, which I'll start with, I've got a prototype of, and we'll ship this later this fall, and it's called One ASP.NET. And let me explain what One ASP.NET means. So I'll jump to VS. So if you're a developer today, any of you in the room, and you go and you say, I want to build a new project, what do I choose? I can choose web forms, or I could choose MVC3, or I could choose MVC4, or I could choose dynamic data. And if I choose MVC4, I'll choose that. Well, then there's 5 more questions. So this has gotten complicated over the years. Back in 10 years ago, there was only one option. It was just build an ASP.NET website. And what's funny is people look at all these technologies, they look and say, oh, there's MVC, there's Web API, there's web forms. You can't use them together, can you? And so I've got this demo here. This dialogue looks awful, but this is what we actually will clean up and make in the future, which is imagine everything in this list goes away, and there's one option that's an ASP.NET web application. I would select that, And then what's going to come up is a dialog box. And this is, as I said, this is an ugly, ugly prototype just to prove we could do it, where I basically can select technology. So imagine you come to here and I'll say, hey, I want MVC, I want Web API, I want web forms, I want optimization. Just check the things that you want. And to kind of prove this actually does work, I'll go check MVC starter templates. I'll check a web form starter template. And I'll check a web pages starter template. These are three frameworks that we build. And I'll click go. And what kind of happens here is, over the years, we started building all of our frameworks into NuGet packages. And so what this dialog basically does is, under the covers, selects a bunch of NuGet packages. So I've got this app now. And when I run it, it does not have a default page. So when I run it, it will make an ugly screen that looks like I've died or something. But what I can do here is I can say, hey, what if I went to MVC/post? And now I'm actually running an MVC controller. I can come in here and put some data in. And that data's there. I could then go to webform/post. There's the data from MVC. Now I'm in a web form page, and I can add some more data. And then finally, I could go to a page called web pages. It's not styled the same way because it doesn't have, we didn't clean this one up as much. But the point I want to break out is if you're in the audience and you've been confused by, do I use MVC, do I use web forms, the reality is it's all ASP.NET, it all works together. Here's my MVC. I've got an MVC controller. In the same application, I've got web forms. Here's my list page in web forms. And in the same application, I've got CSHTML files. So I've got a mix of CSHTML files, ASPX files, all of this all together. And that's what we're calling OneASP.NET. And this is something we'll ship, as I said, we'll ship this fall. All those choices will go away, and you can use all these frameworks together. So that's something I hope people will like, and hopefully it kills some of that confusion that you might have with the products today. Cool? Something else while I'm up on stage, everybody always asks me, is web forms dying, or is this dying, or is that dying? The answer is none of it's dying. We invest in all of it. I'll show a lot of web form stuff today as well. Let me close this out. Yes, what's the question? So the question is, his enterprise doesn't allow him to use NuGet packages because maybe they don't trust them, or maybe they're afraid that there's 6,000 NuGet packages up in the repository and whatnot. So first off, any of our project templates, like when you install Visual Studio 2012, we actually install a cache of Microsoft NuGets on your machine, and that's how our project templates work. So what would happen is all of the NuGets required to make web forms work, to make web pages work, to make MVC work, would all be included in your box by default. Let me do it. Is there a way to prime the cache? There is. It's kind of undocumented, but yes, there is. You can actually create your own project templates and add your own NuGets to it automatically. If you want, come up afterwards and I'll show you how we do it. One more question, then I'm going to move on because I got lots of stuff to show. Actually, you can do more than that. You can come back and turn stuff back off as well. So the idea is the dialog box will be reentrant. Come in and say, hey, I want to start with web forms. Hey, I want to add web API. No, I got rid of the API. Turn it off. So the idea is you can plug and play the features. You're not stuck with some template. And right now, it feels like you make a template choice, and you're stuck. You're not really stuck, but you have to know how to hand wire it back together to not be stuck. So that's kind of how that works. So I'm going to start off and show something we're doing for all of our templates. Let me see if I have it here. Or has it fallen off my list? It's fallen off my list. Let me just dig in here. So this is just a, this is, I'm using web pages here for this demo, but it's not required to use web pages at all. This is something that's coming in RTM that I'm really happy about. So we've always had this functionality in ASP.NET where you can log into a website. So you come up here and you click log in, and we've always had you have to create your own database and stuff like that. But if you're building public-facing websites, when I log into like sites today, it lets me log in with my Facebook, my Twitter, my Windows Live account, or now Microsoft accounts. And so we're enabling that in all of our templates. So while we're going to retain the ability to have our own data store inside of ASP.NET, if you want to let people authenticate into your application using the public services, you can. And I'll show how easy that is to turn on. The code might look a little different based on what technology you're using, but it's there for all the technologies. So what I'm going to do is go to OAuth, websecurity.register, OpenID client, and I'm going to say I want to use a built-in OpenID client. I'll do Google, and maybe I'll do the same thing and turn on .yahoo as well. So then I can go to my login page, and there's a section at the very bottom of the page with all these logins, and it had the message on how to turn them on. I'll just go here, I'll uncomment this, and I'll add two of these in here. Let's do Google. Let's do Yahoo. And make this match. Okay. So now I should be done. I can run my application. Here's my login page, and you see all these buttons now show up. And I'll say, I didn't rename that button. Looks terrible. Fix that. Now I can say Google. It'll jump me over to Google. Log in with my Google account. I come back over here. Say associate. I'm now logged in with Google. So we're going to support this, as I said, for all the OAuth providers, all the OpenID providers. You can write your own providers. So cool. So next thing I'm going to do is I'm going to jump around and show a few things we're doing in web forms before I jump into MVC. So let's look at some of the stuff we're doing in web forms for 4.5. Any web form users in here? About half? So I've got this mega app. If anybody wants the demo after the event, let me know. I have a slide with my email address, and I can email you the demo if you want the demo. It kind of shows every kind of feature that we have. So, whoops. So I'll start with, this is something we're doing in all of our frameworks, is support for async. So I've got a web form page here, and what's different is if I go to my code behind, in my page load, I've marked my method as async. And this is how the new async functionality in .NET 4.5 works, is you basically mark a method as async, and after you do that, you get to use this new keyword called await. And what await does is, normally when you write multi-threaded code in .NET, you call some method, and then you tell the method when it's done to call you back on a delegate. And so imagine if you make an async call, and then when it's done, it calls back, and you decide you want to make another async call, and then you make another call back for it to call back, and it goes in this big nested box of callbacks, and it's really complicated. Imagine you're in halfway through that, and you decide you want to quit. And so the feature that was added in .NET 4.5 is this new magical keyword called await. And what await does for you is, under the cover, the C# compiler is writing that same callback that you would have written by yourself. And what it does is, when I say Literal one, I say, I want to call web client, and that web client go and download a string for me via async. And then what it says is, when you're done, call back to that. So it allows you to write async code that looks like it flows in a straight line, even though it's technically not. Because if you look at the IL the compiler generates, it actually generates the callback, puts the literal to.txt into that callback, which then makes its own call to await, which makes another callback, which then comes back and calls the end of this method, and it falls down. So this, if you wanted to write this in .NET 4, you would have 20 lines of code here to make this work. All I've got to do in .NET 4.5 is I mark my page as being async. Async equals true. I mark my method as being an async method, and then I could use this new await keyword. And then a lot of the libraries in the framework have all been updated to support an async version of their call. And if I run it, it's pretty simple. What it's going to go out there and do is it's going to go grab data from Bing, and it's going to go grab data from Microsoft.com and basically display it on the page. Now, you might be asking, what's the benefit of doing those await calls? If you're on a very busy site, there's a thread pool of IIS can only handle so many, only has so many threads available to receive requests. When you make an async call, you give the thread back to IIS so it can go process more calls while your stuff is running asynchronously. And when you're done, when all your async calls have happened, your method basically says, hey, give me the thread back. It comes back, and the operation completes. So this is really cool stuff. And if you're making websites that do lots of calls to web services, to databases, you can speed up your application quite a bit by using this. The next thing I want to show is a feature called request validation. This is something that we like to say internally that we are a very secure framework. And so we have this this feature that's designed to prevent you from putting things like HTML in your markup. Imagine you have an input, you have a page like this, you let a user put data in, you store the data in the database, and then you replay that information back to the screen at some point to yourself or some third party. If somebody put JavaScript in there, it would actually run that JavaScript and maybe take over their page. And so we've always had this feature that if you try to do things like this, it'll just go bang and you're done. A lot of you, if you've actually used any of the controls from like Telerik or Component One or DevExpress, might have just turned this feature off, because if you use some of their components like their rich editor controls, like one of these things, you end up just turning the feature off, which is dangerous, because you turn it off to make the one control work, but you make your whole site vulnerable to attack. And so what we did in 4.5 is we now allow you to control this on a control-by-control basis. So what I can do is come to my control here, set my validate request mode equal to disabled, this allows this control to accept HTML because I'm using a control designed to do that. And I can show this. I can do like bold, italic, strike through, whatever. That'll now go through. But if I came up here and I tried to type script in this field, which we are not allowing that kind of input, it would blow up. And so we're protecting the field, protecting all your other fields, but allowing you to control it on and off when you need to turn it off. If you do need to turn it off, it is up to you to actually validate things on the server side. One of the other things that I always hear from our customers as we move to the next feature is web forms, MVC, what's going on there? Our customers need to realize that we only get a chance to ship web forms every 3 years, every 2.5, 3 years, whenever a framework comes along, while we can ship MVC on a yearly basis. And so one of our goals with .NET 4.5 was to take all the features that we put in MVC and move them back to web forms. So one of those features was something we call unobtrusive validation. And a demo of this, if I just look at the source code for this page, you can see at the bottom of the page we have all this validation goop. And this is because we wrote this code 10 years ago, and this is kind of the way you did things back 10 years ago. But it makes your pages a little bit more bloated. So what I can do is I can jump in here. I can go to unobtrusive JavaScript. F7. In a 4.5 project, it's actually turned on by default. I turned it off just to show what it used to look like. And turn it back on. As I said, it's on by default. You don't have to change anything. And now the source code for the page. All that stuff at the bottom is just gone. And what happens is we actually replace that by putting attributes on the HTML that we emit. And then there's a validation library that goes and reads those attributes and converts them into validation. And just to show that it still works just like it always has, I press save, I get my validation errors, but I've got a page that's about a third less in size than it was before. So this is an MVC feature that we pulled backwards into web forms. The next feature I'm going to show is called optimization. And I can show I have a web forms demo of this, and I have a MVC version of this. It actually is a totally agnostic feature. This is what I was telling you guys about before, where, and this actual app is a great example of this. So let's look at this app. Let's look at my source code. So let me see here. I've got, so I'm using jQuery UI in this application, and I'm using jQuery. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, there'll be a 16 down here somewhere. 16, 17, 18, 19. So you can see, and I didn't even count the whole page, I might have 20 files being requested. Every time you hit this site, now of course it's only the first request that actually gets this hit. Once your first request happens, your browser is going to cache most of that stuff, but that first hit is actually expensive. So this app actually happens to have optimization turned on, but because I'm actually in debug mode, it doesn't actually enable itself. Because if you're actually building an app, you want to be able to actually trace into your JavaScript. You want to be able to look at your CSS and see what it looks like. So for fun, what I'll do is I'll take this app and I'll set the debug mode equal to false. Save it, run it. Okay. Let's look at the file now. Where did it all go? So what happened is we optimized all those requests down into like two or three requests using a feature called bundling. This page is now a much faster page. Not only do we reduce those number of requests, we actually take the data from those things and compress them together as well. So let me give you an example of what this looks like. Here's a here's what my CSS looks like in my project today. I'll go to my content folder, and I'll look and say I've got this site CSS. It's like this. I've got another one as well with some stuff in it. So let's go to the optimization page and see what this looks like. So in this case, I'm actually referencing that same CSS through the optimization framework. That's what it looks like. So this is before we actually compress it on the wire. Before we compress it on the wire, we go through all the CSS, compress, minify, make it as small as possible. And then when it actually goes across the actual wire to the browser, we're doing gzip on that as well. So you can see that that goes down. I look at my JavaScript, the same kind of thing. This is two or three JavaScript files all compressed together, all the space taken out by default. Oops. I've got one more area of this, and I'll show you how this works. What happens is we have a new folder called AppStart that's in all of our projects, and it contains stuff where we actually enable things like routing and bundling. And so what you'll see here, these are the ones that we put in by default. Here's MS Ajax created in a bundle. Here's Modernizer in a bundle. Here's my content, my two CSS files in a bundle. And here's all those jQuery UI themes in a bundle. You basically define bundles inside of your bundleconfig.cs, and then what you do is in your content page, you reference the bundle. So notice that when I created the bundle, I gave it a name. And so in my page, I just referenced that bundle. Now you might ask the question of, okay, well that one file, how does it expand into all these other files? We have some actual controls and helpers that you put in your actual master page saying, emit this bundle, and in debug mode, we'll emit all those files. In release mode, we'll emit the one file that's all compressed and minified, preserving both debug scenarios. The final thing is, we were working on this feature And people in the community said, hey, we've already got these bundlers in the community. We think we can write better ones than you can. Great. If you can, we're all for it. The one we use is the same one that is used on the Microsoft MSN property. Super optimized. But I have an example here where I've actually written two custom ones. I've got one called Less Minify. And so the way it works is in my bundle config for a custom one, what I can do is I create what we call a dynamic folder bundle. I give it a name for less, that's in the path. I give it a star of that less, it accepts less files. And I give it the name of the bundler, which is my less minifier. And all my less minifier does is it takes that data, and in my case, I've added a NuGet package called dotless core, which processes less files, and it runs it through the less parser and then passes it back up. So you can take any optimization features that are out there today and use them through our system if you want. And I'll just demo that real quick. So less is actually interesting because it's actually kind of a language. So in less, what you do is you build macros in CSS. And so you might see here that I've got a macro called rounded corners, which takes a parameter, and then I use that parameter everywhere. And then my header calls it with no value, which means it takes the default value of 5, and my footer calls it again with a value of 10 pixels. And so not only can we do all the compression and minification, but we can allow you to use things like CoffeeScript and less via this technology. So I can come up here and I'll click the CoffeeScript one, and you'll see what actually happens here is it references the wrong file. It's referencing the CoffeeScript file. Or I clicked the wrong one. I did click coffee, you're right. Yep, there you go. So you can see that here's my 5-pixel one for my header, and here's my 10-pixel one for the footer. So you can see it took that less file, ran it, and created CSS on the fly. So not only can you bundle and minify, but you can also do other parsers like CoffeeScript and less. And I think this is one of my favorite features in .NET 4.5 and ASP.NET. As I said, it works across all the technologies. You're going to find that your apps, just out of the box, should run faster than they've ever run before. What was the question? It saves it. So what it actually does is we not only does it save it, but one of the things you could run into with this kind of technology is what happens if you change one of your script files? The URL actually has to change. So every time you make a change, so what we do is we actually go and create a unique token based on the hash of all the files. And the script reference or the CSS reference that we put in your page contains a token at the end that contains that hash. So as your files change, it will create a new unique URL, so you never have to worry about somebody getting a stale reference to old files. The final web form thing that I want to show before I jump into some MVC is something called model binding. And let me show you how this works. So any of you that are using web forms, using data controls? So what we've done in data controls is a couple of cool things. First off, we had a feature in MVC where not only do you have a data control, but you actually give it a type. And so you might notice here that, I'll take this off, but I have this item type. And if I select this, it'll actually go find all the types in my project. I'll select the person type. And then in the past, what we've done is we've said you had to have some data source control. But that data source control typically does kinds of magic that you don't really know what it is or have control over. So what MVC did is basically say, hey, we're gonna let you have actions on your page that actually define each of these things, and you write the code. And we thought we'd give that to web form developers as well. Most of you probably have written your own data layer and you're using your own custom data layer, and it's kind of hard to do that with our controls today. So first off, I give it a type. Then I can define select method, update method, delete method. And in front of those, so here's my select method. All it does is grabs my database contacts and returns persons. The other benefit of The other benefit of providing a type is I get to, instead of doing, in the past, we would do evals here. Why is it complaining? I sure did. Feature works. Good catch, guys. So that was the feature I was just going to show, which is in the past, for data binding, you would do this eval mechanism and say eval first name. That is not strongly typed. And as a result, it would have just gone ahead and you would have seen no squigglies at all and your application would have failed at runtime. Now, because we have strongly typed data, I get IntelliSense. Here's first name, last name, title. And you can see the compiler actually saw that this was bad data and complained. I can run this. I get the names on the screen. I've got a slightly more a bigger example of this as well. This is using a form view. And in this case, I've actually defined a select method, an insert method, an update method. And you can see all these in my code behind here. Another cool feature of model binding is you don't have to actually write your database logic in the page. You can actually, when you give us that type for the select method, update method, delete method, you can give us a class name as well, and we'll actually go to your data layer and call them directly in your data layer. Just run this and show that it works. I'm changed. The final thing is on model binding that I want to show before I jump into some other stuff is we did a feature a couple years ago called Dynamic Data that required you to create a new project, and so it didn't get as much uptake as we wanted. When we started working on model binding, it has all the things in place to make Dynamic Data actually be something you might want to use again. So I've taken that same sample I just ran before, and I changed something. Instead of putting text boxes in my page, I put dynamic controls in my page. And they work very similar to text boxes. I give them the name of the field in my data model. I give it that I want to edit. And you might ask, what benefit do you get if I change my text boxes to those? Well, another feature that we have is if you're doing validation, like I was showing in one of the things earlier, with MVC, we created this notion where you could actually go and put these attributes on your model. And so I've got an attribute called required, I've got one called string length, and this allows you to put validation logic in one place. By putting your validation on this object model, we will do two things. We will, at the server side, run all this validation before we accept a data operation. If you actually switch to dynamic control, like I was showing before, we will automatically, the dynamic control will emit the text box as usual, but it will also go look and see if there's a required attribute or a string length attribute. We have a regex attribute, a range attribute, and if so, it will apply the correct validation control automatically into your output. And so this means I've got required for ID, I've got required for last name, and I've got a length of 10, required in length on first name. So if I run this third version of the page, it will, model binder 2, yep. What will happen is if I start going and changing the data here, you note I'm getting validation. I don't have very nice messages, but I got these little asterisks, which if I hover over, it might actually show me a message. Yeah. And if I go and try to type data in these fields, on the first name, because it has a string length of 10, stops. So the idea is put your validation logic on your model, not in your pages, which means if you change your model, your entire application updates at the same time. This is something we've done in MVC for a while, and we want to bring this back to web forms. So this, you know, I think these data features are going to be great for everybody. The one thing I'm not going to show, but I will talk about, is we also have gone through an HTML5-ized web forms. So we went through and if you do a text field, it's now got a drop-down that lets you select any of the HTML5 types that exist. If you have a file upload control, it now will support multiple file uploads at the same time. And all of the stuff in the response objects, request and response objects, actually support that stuff. So we've got full HTML5. Yeah. Yes, they're already in there. So the email data type came in .NET 4. We have a whole bunch of new ones in .NET. Huh? Yes, they will. Yeah, you put email on there. We have credit card. We have zip code. There's a whole pile of these things. We added another 5 or 10 of them in .NET 4 or 5. Basically, what we try to do with the annotations is make them match what jQuery Validate does, because that's one of the libraries that we use under the covers to do the actual validation. Did anybody go to Damien's mobile talk? A few people, because I'm gonna just briefly maybe duplicate some of that. Was anybody in my talk this morning on Visual Studio? Couple? So there'll be just a brief moment of overlap there. I'll try not to spend too much time on the stuff that I overlap. So what I'm gonna do now is show some of our new MVC features. Yeah. Yes. You can go that far. I don't think we'll give you IntelliSense in the tool for that, but you can actually call them. So I'm going to create an MVC4 application and do a few things with it here. So let's create a default application. And I'm ready to run here. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a data model. Add a class to this. I'll call it widget. And this is, I did talk earlier today and people weren't aware of this. You can type prop tab and it does a get set for you automatically. You just give it the type you want. I'll just call it ID. Prop tab. Do a string. Call it a name. And I can try it. No. I'll do an int. Oops. And we'll do maybe a quantity or something like that. Save that. Something cool here is as I show this, so what I've done is I've got a type in my project, and I'm going to now scaffold some pages on that type. So what I'm going to do is go to my controller folder, and I'm going to right-click, and I'm going to say add a controller. We'll call it the widget controller, and I'll give it a type of widget. And I'll tell it, yeah, let's make a new data context. So this will actually go build my database code for me as well. I'll say I've got a widget context. Now, as I show this, I'm in an MVC application. What's cool is this fall, we're going to bring this exact same functionality to WebForm app developers as well. So as I do this demo and show scaffolding and stuff with Entity Framework code first, if you're a WebForm developer in the room, you will get the same functionality this fall. So now I've got an app that I can actually go and run. So let me run it. Just prove that it works. Now, while I'm here and running this, one of the things that I want to show as well is here's my name, here's my quantity. Seems to work. You might notice this template is pretty cool. It uses something called media selectors that notice as I shrink it down, the content changes. First, the bullets come off, the home about contact moved to the middle. The page is very dynamic and designed to fit on mobile. And so all the templates that we're providing you guys are mobile ready from this standpoint. Our goal is we know that mobile devices, tablets, and phones are everywhere. How do you make an app that actually works in this scenario? So our CSS, if you actually look in the CSS file, you can see the tricks we do to do this, where we can say, if your display is over this width, use these styles. If it's over this width, use these styles, which allows me to make that work really well. So I've got this app, and I want to show another feature we have, which is called Entity Framework migrations. So if I come in here and go to my widget context and go look at my tables, here's my widget table and here's my columns. You might ask yourself, what happens if I want to go add more columns? So I'm going to go add a, what should I add? Date, time, purchased. And do a get set. And I'll go run my application. And now my database and my data model don't match anymore. And when I do this and go to widget, boom, we're done. And that's because the database model has decided that, you know, it's detected things are different. And one of the cool features we added as part of this is a new feature called migrations. And you're seeing a bug. See, this pipeline's not run because a pipeline is already running. Pipelines cannot run concurrently. That is a bug that we have in RC. That bug is fixed for RTM. So when that happens to you, that's basically a reload. Good. So what I will do here is I'm going to say enable migrations. And migrations is a feature that some languages like Ruby have had for a while that we're now bringing into for .NET developers. So when I say enable migrations, a couple things are going to happen in my project. First off, it's going to go and look at my data model and look at my database and go, your database contains these things, and it's going to write a method that will actually create these things. There's a method called the up method. Notice it says create table widgets, and it gives it the ID, the name, and the quantity fields, because those already exist in the database. So this is code that can be used to create my tables. Now, I added new fields. I added that new field. I added a purchase date. So let's say add-migration purchase date. Oops. It's not going to like that, but I'll just do it again. So I add a migration called purchase date. And what's going to happen is it's going to go look at, from when my database was first created, what have I changed in my model? And I added that new column, that purchase column. And so you see my up method says add a column. Let me shrink this a little bit. And my down method says remove that column. Now, this is a date time, which is a non-nullable type. So I can also go change this code if I want as well. So I'm going to add a default value here. Close that. So if I wanted to, I could write my own SQL here as well. If I'm an expert, I can write my own SQL to make these changes. You don't have to use the code that we wrote. You're welcome to change it however you want. That migration exists now. And now I can say update database, and it will run as many migrations as required to bring my database up to snuff. So now if I go to my Server Explorer, I go look at my table, go to widgets, there's my purchased. So that's simple to keep your database in sync all the time. I don't have time to show it all, but it's got a lot of other features. You might say, hey, I want to go be able to create this database on a remote server. I can run a command and tell update database to give me a script, and it will actually give me the SQL script from the first step to the last step that I give it, which I can then go run on a remote server. I showed in a talk earlier today that the publishing feature inside of Visual Studio also supports running these migrations on the remote server, so you can actually develop, make some changes with up methods. When you publish the next time, it will actually go take whatever you changed and run that on the server. As I said, this is a feature that Ruby on Rails has had for a while. Pretty cool. Now what I want to show is HTML5, a little bit of HTML5. So if I run this application and I go look at that widget page, one of the things that we modified in MVC, if I go look at view the source code for quantity, I can spell. Here is the input type that we generate for the quantity, and you'll notice that I don't want quantity, I want date. Oh, I need to rescaffold my page. Give me 1 second. So I added that new date field, but I didn't modify my controller to actually have that, modify my views to contain that new field. So I can come here. I can run widget controller again, give it my type, give it my context. And what it should do is detect those exist. Let me overwrite them. And so now when I run the page, that date field is going to show up. And what I want to show is when the date field shows up, this same feature exists in the web forms model binding I was showing before as well. So we now emit HTML5 in its scenario as well. If I go to purchased, what we've done is the input type on this, notice you'll see here, type equals date time. And so this is the beginning of what HTML5 does is it has something called, comically enough, it has something called WebForms 2. We already have WebForms in ASP.NET, but they decided to call forms in HTML5 WebForms 2. And in WebForms 2, there's the type, which used to just be like text, password, there's like three things you could set it to in HTML4 and below. It now supports a variety of rich types. The benefit of some of these rich types, like date time, is if you're actually displaying a page on a mobile device, like a phone, it will actually put a smart date picker up on your screen when it sees that input type of date time. Now, all the desktop browsers have not caught up to that yet. I've heard Chrome 20 might be the first one that does it. So we're emitting the HTML5 tags, but you might want to do something to work around that. So what I'm going to show here real quick, I've just got some code I can snip in here. We include a library in our projects, both our MVC projects and our web form projects, called Modernizer. And what Modernizer does is it allows you to go and detect what features the browser has. We also include jQuery UI in all these apps. So what I can do is go into my layout page, and I'm going to jump down to the bottom here where we include jQuery. I'm going to jump to my notepad file here and just copy a snippet of code, and I'll explain the code. All I'm doing here is adding jQuery UI here, and then I'm calling Modernizer and saying, hey, Modernizer, does this browser support input type of date? And if it does not, what I do is I find all input types on the page that have date time, a type of date time, and I add a jQuery UI date picker to that. So by running this, what'll happen is if I access this app on a desktop, I'll get a nice picker for all the browsers that don't support it. If I run it on a phone, the phone won't use jQuery UI, it'll actually use its native library. You can just run this to show it. I can come here and edit. Now I've got a daytime picker. So not too hard to make this kind of stuff work. Now I've got an app that'll work great on a mobile. It'll work great on a desktop. It's got daytime pickers using HTML5 data types. The next thing I might want to do. Do what? Oh, I'm not trying to do purchase date. I don't know, does jQuery have a time picker? Yeah, I could do one then. The next thing I want to do is I want to install another package via NuGet. And this would be the jQuery.mobile. This is something where Damien might have showed just a little bit of this. We have a package that has jQuery. So as part of our new MVC4, we have a mobile template if you want to start from mobile. But most people in the room probably already have an app already. And the question would be, how do I actually make my current app do mobile support? So I can add this package. And I can add it again. Hopefully that doesn't hurt anything. What happened is I added the runtime package. I went and said add the latest bleeding edge package. It tells me, here's a direction you have to turn this on. I need to add this line to my global ASAX. So I'll go add this line to my global ASAX. Let me just make sure this worked. I ran it and put the wrong package in the first time. Actually, it did work. Perfect. That looks correct. So now I can run this, and my app should behave exactly the same. But if I bring it up in a mobile emulator, which doesn't fit on my screen anymore, let's grab the URL. I bring it up in a mobile emulator. I see a different version of the page. I see a version of the page designed specifically for mobile. It's using jQuery Mobile. And if you've been to sites like ESPN, they like to let you switch back and forth from like the desktop view to the mobile view. In this case, I can explain how this works. I've got this new layout file called layout.mobile. So we have this new support for mobile pages in MVC where I can create any page that I have and say dash.mobile and create a mobile version of it. So what happens here is when you're on a device that is mobile, instead of displaying layout, we display layout mobile. And layout mobile has a few things in it. One thing, it does have a picker. Here it is. It's the view switcher, which allows you to switch back and forth. If I go move that same switcher into my main page, that switcher only will appear on mobile devices. So if you're on a desktop browser, this will not mess up the page. Try to keep that formatted somehow. If I go over back to my mobile device, does it have a refresh? No, it does not. Oh, there you go. So now it's detected that I'm on a mobile and I'm allowed to switch back and forth between the two views. I want to show one more thing on mobile real quick, and then I'll move off, and I'll show Web API and SignalR. So I want to show how easy it is to mobilize a page. So I'm going to go up to my view folder and find widget. And my default widget page is called index. And so if I want to mobilize this, what I would do, I've got some two lines of code I can copy from over here. The way jQuery UI works is basically you write HTML elements just like you do today, but you put a little bit of metadata on them. So I put something on here that says, hey, I want to show something in a list. I want to add a special style to it, and I want to have a filter on it. So maybe if my list contains like 100 items, that's kind of cumbersome to scroll on the phone. The user might want to be able to type something and find their item immediately. So all I've got to do now is just remove some of this code. I'll take the for each loop that I've got here, move it inside of that. I'm going to remove some of the stuff I have here. Basically what I'm doing is I've decided that I want to trim this down for a mobile device. I don't want to display as much information as I was showing before. I'll create an LI tag because I'm in a UL. I'll put the name inside of there. And then that should be it. So I just removed some information. I got my mobile version of the page. I'll save it. And let me just go up here. This thing's kind of funny. I'll go to widget. Now I've got my mobile version of the page. It's not the same as the desktop. It's got this filter. If I type something that doesn't match, it goes away. It comes back. Once again, it's showing you how fast you can take an app and make it mobile. So that's MVC4, Entity Framework Code First, mobile, HTML5. If I can do this in 10 minutes or 15 minutes up on the stage, the hope is that you guys can do it the same way we can. So. I think those are cool features. So let me jump into another demo real quick of something that is super cool called SignalR. My buddy Damien is doing a SignalR talk right now in another room. And this is pretty cool. So if anybody's ever tried to write code and then call code from JavaScript and it requires proxies and all this kind of hard stuff, the goal of SignalR is to do something we call real time. A lot of applications do real-time stuff today. You're on some application that updates on the fly on the page. If you've ever been to like a travel site and you start saying you want to book a reservation, it says, hey, I'm looking for reservations or looking for flights. That's an area where real-time can go into play where you're waiting, and when an update occurs, you want the update to come through. So Let me run this app, and then I'll explain how it works. I should have posted this to the cloud, because it's kind of fun when people can just jump in it. So I'll create a browser over here. I'll create another browser over here. I'll share the URLs between them. So I've got two apps up. Now, what's wild about this, if I come over here and say, hello, TechEd, shows up in both browsers. So effectively, I have a chat application. So how much code did I have to write that chat application? Let's go look. First off, I write what's called a hub. And a hub is something that can send and receive messages. And so the hub is simple. It's a C# class, derives from hub. And all I do is I create a method on it called send. And send takes a string. It could take whatever parameters it wants to take. And when it receives that string, all it does is calls, there's a special method called, or property called clients. And it can call, this is dynamic, meaning I could call add message. I can name this whatever I want. It takes the message passed in and calls all the clients and passes that message to them. So, and that's my entire hub for writing a chat app. What, one line of code and a class. If I go look at my markup, what I basically do is I include a few script files over here. The special one being the SignalR/hub script files, which actually does all the JavaScript proxies for me. And then all I've got to do is I'm going to write a little bit of JavaScript. I'm going to call something connection.chat. And if you think about this, what I'm doing is I'm saying, go find the chat object in my application and create a connection to it. So I made a connection to that hub. And then you'll notice that it says, hey, when the chat add message is called, run this code. And remember, add message is what we actually wrote right here. If I renamed it here, I'd have to rename it on the other side, but it's that simple that when the hub calls add message, this method in my JavaScript will be called, and I can go take that message. And in my case, what I'm doing is I have a UL here called messages, and it basically that code says, go take that and append it to that UL. Now, the secondary thing that I have here is I have what I call a broadcast. So I've got a button down here. Got an input type equal text. You can type into it. It's got a button called broadcast. When the broadcast button is clicked, what I do is I call chat.send. Once again, remember, my method on my hub is called send. So what that's doing is when I say chat.send and pass the value of that text box, it's calling the C# method on the chat hub. That chat hub is then going and saying, all the clients that are subscribed to me, I'm going to send that out, at which point it will come back in to all the clients via their add message and put this data on the screen. So you can write what we call a real-time application in a couple lines of code. This is an awesome feature. So if you're writing stock tickers, I mean, we've had people from various large financial institutions come to us because they want to have like phone apps, browser apps, tablet apps that all basically see updates in real time. And this is a mechanism that allows you to write those types of apps. We have clients for this for iOS, Android, Windows Phone. We have obviously the stuff you're seeing here that works in ASP.NET. It works in pure JavaScript. Obviously, you see the JavaScript here. This is a feature that we have today. If you Google SignalR and GitHub, it's on GitHub. Later this year, it will ship as an official part of our web stack on ASP.NET. And I think it's an awesome feature. Damian Edwards did a talk today. These talks are all being recorded. If you think this is a cool feature, please go see his talk or watch his talk. The chat hub? When you say wired up, so what's actually going on that's wiring it up is this magic right here. I don't have time to drill into it. If you want to come up afterwards, notice that this script does not exist. There is nothing in my page called SignalR/hubs. And so what will actually happen is part of the SignalR is catching that URL. When that URL is hit, a proxy is generated that writes all the code that wires both sides up. Come up afterwards, and I'll actually show you the source code and show you exactly how it hooks up and talks to itself. I do want to say one more thing about it that might answer part of your question as well is, how does it talk? It talks via two mechanisms. If you're on a modern client that supports HTML5 WebSockets, it talks via WebSockets. So it means it's very, very efficient because it's going to open a connection that stays open the entire time, and messages are just going to come up to it and be received. If you're on a client that does not support WebSockets, it's going to fall back down to something we call long polling, which basically means it's polling on a continual basis. The cool thing about SignalR is it takes that problem away from you. Normally, if you were writing these types of apps today, you'd have to be writing your HTML5 version, you'd have to write your long polling version, and we just say write it one way, the SignalR way, and we'll do all that work for you. WebSockets, if you want to have the WebSocket work, you have to be on Windows Server 2012, which is the one that supports WebSockets. That's not my decision. I work on the ASP.NET team. I don't work on the Windows team. So just to let you know, on Tuesday when I get back, I'm actually meeting with those guys to actually ask again if we can backport the thing. We at least want to try to see if they can back... We're at least going to try to backport for developers. So at least if you're a developer and you're on an older operating system, you can develop on the older operating system. That would be like the compromise that I would... I'd like to have the full thing. I've got one more demo I want to show. And this is a feature called Web API. And Web API is all about what, as I said earlier today, what I think the future of web programming is on ASP.NET. I don't think anything's going to change in the next couple of years, but if you look at the Twitters and the Facebooks, these apps expose themselves via APIs. And we want to make it very easy for you as developers to expose your apps via APIs as well. And let me show you what my API looks like, and I've got a couple of simple samples of calling it. So I've got a comment database behind the scene that just has a few folks in it, and if I want to allow somebody to call this, all I do is write a method that returns an iQueryable called comment, and that's my call. So let's see what it looks like for me to call that from a client. I've got a simple page here. I'll just start with the beginning of my demo here. I've got a simple page here with a couple of samples. The first one is I just want to call that get comments. So I'm going to press go, and a bunch of folks from my team are going to show up. In fact, people that used to be on my team, Phil. So what did I have to do to make that work? So I'll go look at the page, get simple get, or even better, I'll look at the JavaScript. This is basically the JavaScript I wrote. I wrote a line of JavaScript that goes and calls api.comments. When the data comes back, it comes back as data, and I'm using a technology called Knockout, and all I got to do is give Knockout that data, and it will do all the data binding for me. So it's very easy to write a JSON call there. If I'm in my browser, I'll show it on the next demo. So that's showing a get. If I want to do CRUD, notice I can delete things if I wanted to. I can come in here and add another one. And what I'll do before I add the other one is I'll press F12 and bring my browser tools up. I'll turn network sniffing on. And I'll come down here and I'll say, let's add this comment. And when that happens, you can see two things that went through the browser. First off, my JavaScript called and sent a post. What did this post look like? You can see it has foo as the text. It has foo as the author and foo as the email. That's the data that I sent. And then what we got back what happened then is it called my API. It's going to call my post comment. And my post comment's pretty simple. It takes a comment. So what Web API does under the covers is it takes the JSON that I passed back to it, converts it back into an object. My application uses that object and then can easily stick that object in the database. So you can see that all I do is I call my database and I say, add the comment. And just to play nice, what we do is we send the comment back to the other side so it knows that everything came in very clean. But you can see that's pretty simple. I'll do one more demo here. I'll jump up to the next one, which is, here I've got some people in my database, and I want to do paging. Well, the nice thing about the fact that we're using iQueryable is the power of link is now available to me. I can do take and skip and all those kinds of things on my data. So what we do here is I'll say, how about a size of 1, index of 0. That should bring just Phil back. Index of 1, so I'm slowly paging through the data, brings Henrik back. Just jump back and show the controller a little bit more. The thing is, we want to make this super simple for you guys to write. So if this looks a lot like MVC code, and that was by design. So I have a get comment that just returns an iQueryable of comments. I've got a get comment by an ID. The ID comes in, we return the comment. We're doing all the JSON translation on the fly for you. We actually will do more than just JSON. If the requesting client asked for XML, we would have sent XML back. So we dynamically look and see what content the requester is looking for and asking for and send that back. We allow you to actually override that and support your own content. So for example, there's a demo we have on the ASP.NET website called a contact manager. And in the contact manager, if you ask for an image, we would give you the image of the person. So it's super, super easy to write these things, to write RESTful methods that can be called. We can take JSON or XML, convert it into objects, return them back and forth. You had a question? The question is this meant to replace WCF in the web space? What we would say is if you want to do REST, this is the technology that you should use. If you want to do SOAP messaging, you want to do message-based stuff, you should use WCF. So, I mean, there is a distinction there. REST should be this. There's people that have actually got REST working on top of WCF, but it requires lots of boilerplate code, and it's very complicated. If I look at my web config, I have nothing. There's no configuration. If you look at my application here, I have almost no attributes. We basically, what happened was we took the WCF team and the ASP.NET team and merged them last summer. And as we were working on this, we tried to take some of the simplicity that ASP.NET's been trying to do and infuse that into the WCF side of the house. And that's what you're seeing here, is you're seeing something that's very easy to write this stuff. This is stuff even easier to write in ASM-X was. And I think it's awesome. So the question is, what's the difference between that? So I'm not going to demo that, but this stack gives you full access to the HTTP response and request. And so if you're doing a controller that returns JSON, you can do that. But it's not very trivial to go and change the HTTP response to add other headers and other stuff to it without making it really dirty. The goal of Web API is to make HTTP a first-class citizen. So everything here, you can see a little bit in my sample here, where I'm changing headers. I'm creating a response with headers. There's a bigger one down here somewhere. Yeah, maybe not in this sample. But the real goal is to make HTTP a first-class citizen. So that's where we see the difference being is. You know, in the past, we used to have people always ask us, why not just use MVC and return, you know, a JSON action? And that's great for small things and simple things. But if I dug into further demos here, I have demos where I'm in the JavaScript client, and I'm doing validation, and I'm flowing validation back up through web API. Doing that in MVC with JSON result would be pretty complicated. If that didn't answer your question, just come up. That's all the demos I was going to show, so I really thank everybody for coming. Please go to the party tonight. If you have any questions, please come up. We've done so much. I've got so much more stuff I could show. It's just like trying to shove as much stuff in, you know, 75 minutes as I could. So hope you guys enjoyed it.